From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As President Trump, during his recent visit to Normandy, France, enjoyed his photo ops with military veterans, news reports did not mention his recent plan to pardon U.S. service members that have been convicted of war crimes. Indeed, Trump appears to have backed off, at least temporarily, from pardoning several people whose conduct in the Iraq or Afghanistan wars of the past two decades was so egregious that even vets and the military establishment were aghast. But perhaps we shouldn't be surprised in the least, given Trump's tenuous relationships to laws and morality. After all, he himself faces the strong likelihood of criminal prosecution after leaving office. We turn to Rebecca Gordon. She's the author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. She teaches in the philosophy department at the University of San Francisco and is a member of the Wartime's Tiempo de Guerras Collective. Her latest piece was published by Tom Dispatch, entitled Clemency for the Lowly, Free Passes for the Mighty. Welcome to the program, Rebecca.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So where do you think this idea even originated? Some have suggested that it was essentially a Fox News host that suggested or advised Trump to do this sort of thing, to pardon war criminals. It seems that Fox News is now, you know, has been for the last 2 years shaping American presidential policy.
That would appear to be the case. It does seem to be the major place where President Trump learns anything about what is actually happening in the world. And to me, it's particularly ironic that he would choose to support the troops by offering to pardon, and in one case, actually pardoning already a military figure who has been convicted of a war crime. And I suspect that people, and in fact, I know because I teach a course at the University of San Francisco in War, Torture, and Terrorism, that which is taken both by members of Reserve Officer Training Corps and also veterans, and they are all very clear that they do not feel supported when anybody in government suggests that they should not abide by the Geneva Conventions and the other rules and laws of war. Rather, the opposite. They take great pride in the fact that part of what their military culture is the observation of these rules and these laws. So, yes, I think the idea came from Fox. I think that Trump loves it, especially because he, although he himself never actually served in the military, and as he one time said, I believe to Howard Stern, that his Vietnam was gonorrhea. Nonetheless, he loves to surround himself with military people and warmongers, and I think he likes to feel that the soldiers love him.
Right.
So, yes.
So let's talk about Michael Behana, who is the one soldier that Trump has already pardoned, just to give us an idea of the kind of people that Trump wants to use his presidential pardon power for. He basically has the highest power in the nation to do what he's doing. So who is this vet, Michael Behana?
Michael Behana was convicted in 2009 of murdering an Iraqi prisoner. This man was named Ali Mansour Mohammed, and he was suspected of being someone who was creating these what were called IEDs, improvised explosive devices, and he was accused of being someone who had been involved in that. He was captured by the U.S. military and interrogated. But they decided in the end that he would be released. And so he was supposed to take him home, Behana was. But what Behana did instead was he took him to a secluded area, he stripped him naked, and he shot him dead. And then later claimed that he did this because he was under attack by a naked man who had made a lunge for his gun. So now Behana has a presidential pardon, and as I said in my article, Ali Mansour Mohammed is still dead.
Wow. Eddie Gallagher is another vet that Trump has considered a pardon for. He even tweeted about him. He's a former Navy SEAL. And I mean, he's basically announced that he would be moved to a less restrictive confinement while he awaits his day in court. Who's Eddie Gallagher? And I understand that Trump hasn't pardoned him and has sort of suggested that he wants the trials to proceed.
Okay, so this is a case that has become even more complex since I wrote the article, but Eddie Gallagher is a Navy SEAL, and even among his fellow SEALs, he is considered something of a loose cannon and a dangerous man. And among the things that he's accused of are stabbing a defenseless teenage captive to death. He was a sniper, so he was literally picking off schoolgirls and old men as they walked along the streets in Mosul, and he used to like to indiscriminately fire his machine gun at civilian neighborhoods in Mosul and also indiscriminately fire off rockets just sort of into the places where people were living in Mosul, Iraq. Now, what's become more complex is it turns out that the prosecuting authorities illegally attached a capture device to an email that they sent to Gallagher's defense attorneys, and this piece of malware was discovered by the defense attorneys, and it now looks as though the whole case is going to be a mistrial and he may end up not going to trial at all.
Wow, just because of a technical error? Wow.
Well, it was more than a technical error. It was an illegal
So it was done
act.
On purpose, I see.
It was done on purpose, but the question remains, why? Did the prosecutors do this because they really wanted to have a better chance of prosecuting him? Or was this, in fact, a roundabout way of getting him off? And I can't possibly comment. I don't know the answer to that. Right. But in any case, yeah, it's a mess.
So in Trump's view, and I assume Fox News's view, or the particular Fox News host that suggested this to him, the idea of pardoning military war criminals or people convicted of war crimes or, you know, crimes that would be considered war crimes, do you think that that's the sense of that Trump thinks is a impunity that is deserving of America, that America can and should just engage in any kind of conduct that it wants to because it's America, and in there's a symbolism to freeing these specific people?
I think you're right, and I think that this is a logic that long precedes Donald Trump. It's a logic that's been there in American exceptionalism, as it's often called, and it's a circular logic that essentially goes, the United States is the leader of the free world and the leader in the fight for human rights around the world. Therefore, anything the United States does, by definition, cannot be a war crime because the United States is the leader against war crimes in the world. And it's this logic that just goes round and round, and it's almost impossible to enter into this logical circle. And there's a long history of this. So going back as long ago as the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, which people as old as I am will remember, which took place in 1968 and was revealed by Seymour Hersh in 1969. This was a day-long massacre of one little village in Vietnam in the Mekong Delta, where U.S. Army people spent the day raping and murdering women and killing everybody in the village. They herded people into houses and then set the houses on fire. And as people came running out, they shot them down. They stopped for lunch and then went back and kept doing this work, if you will. And it later turned out through important work that was done in the early 2000s by Nick Turse, among other people, that the Army actually knew that My Lai was not a one-off aberration, but in fact, it was part of an ongoing strategy that was called Operation Speedy Express, and it caused the deaths of tens of thousands of Vietnamese civilians in South Vietnam, in the part of Vietnam that we were fighting to save. So the point, though, about all of these massacres, and really the point about people like Behenna and Eddie Gallagher, is yes, these war crimes are terrible, and yes, you're absolutely right. The U.S. stance has always been, by definition, we can't commit war crimes. But the truth is that the big criminals, the real criminals, if you will, are the ones that put these members of the armed forces, these low-level criminals, in position to be committing these crimes in the first place.
So if, you know, how do you explain then the pushback from veterans and even the military against Trump's idea? Is it that in so blatantly wanting to pardon these war criminals, Trump undermines this facade that there is such a thing as military justice? And of course, in individual cases, military justice can and has worked.
I think you're exactly right. And I think we have to recognize that the military itself is a complex society, right? It's a complex set of cultures, oftentimes in conflict with each other, so that the various branches of the military don't get along, dislike each other. And then there is conflict between the actual career military and their civilian bosses in the Pentagon, so that none of this is simple. And none of it is necessarily, or all of it is not necessarily conscious. That is, the military can simultaneously hold in their minds the idea that we are absolutely committed to the Geneva Conventions and the rules and laws of war, which are also called international humanitarian law. We're totally committed to that, and at the same time can use the fact that they believe in their commitment to justify permission to do pretty much anything because of that commitment. You can violate the commitment because you have the commitment. Mm-hmm. And this is actually, in the world of philosophical ethics, there is a name for this approach, and it's called the dirty hands approach. And the idea is this, that a ruler or somebody in a high position of power who is deeply committed to all the values that we really care about, like human rights, may find himself, and it's always described as himself, in the position of having, for the greater good, for the good of his country as a whole, to violate those very commitments just this one time in order to save the country. And this is a famous example of this is given by Michael Walzer, who's a philosopher who's well known for his just war theory. But he wrote a famous article that was resurrected during the conflicts over torture in the early 2000s, in which he posits the example of a ruler of somebody who's just come to power in a bloodless coup, who really believes in democracy, and he hears that the armed rebels have planted a bunch of bombs, and he has to decide whether to order the torture of this captured rebel in order to save people who are in these apartment houses that are going to be bombed. So the whole hypothetical case is absurd on a number of ways. But nonetheless, the basic question is, are we required, because we're the good guys, to do the things that the bad guys would do just occasionally, because in the long run, we're really the good guys? And I think there's a lot of that logic that also goes on in the military and in the civilian heads of the military.
So, Rebecca, Trump, of course, recently marked the 75th anniversary of D-Day in Europe during his trip there. He met with military veterans. He has, of course, boasted about being the, you know, military's best friend, even as he justified not serving in the Vietnam War because of so-called bone spurs. But then he said that when asked about it, he said that it was a war that he didn't support, as if to sort of admit that he tried to get out of that war improperly. He also said, well, he's made up for not serving because he's overly funded the military so well. In any case, I'm wondering whether you think that Trump's approach to the military is one that the military is really truly embracing, because on the one hand, his own personal story is kind of an embarrassment for the military to be aligned with. On the other hand, he's funding them. So I know the military is not a monolith, but how do you think it's being received?
So I think, again, it's very complicated, and a lot of it has to do with the particular advisors he's surrounded himself with. So, for example, he's brought in John Bolton. And I don't know if you've been watching, but I imagine you have, that Bolton is trying to gin up at least two wars,
right,
one against Iran and the other an invasion of Venezuela. And he is really over there whispering in one ear you know, let's do this. On the other hand, I think that the military establishment and the career military are not in the least bit interested in getting involved, especially in a war against Iran, which would make Iraq look like a picnic, and Iraq was no picnic for the Iraqis or for the U.S. military. We don't have the numbers of soldiers under arms. We don't have anything like what we would need just on a logistical level to actually conduct a war against Iran. So there's this conflict going on between the civilians who have no idea what war is really like and the military who are not eager to initiate a new war in that part of the world since the last few haven't gone very well. So there's that conflict. On the other hand, the military loves money. And the one thing I think we should remember, however, is that Trump thinks that he does a lot of things, like he gives the military money. But the truth is, we don't live in a fiat government in which right. He's like Jean-Luc Picard and he says, make it so, right. And suddenly the military has money. What the administration does is every year they present a budget to Congress and Congress decides what budget to pass. So when he says he gives the military money, what he means is that in the budget that he presents to Congress, which is usually dead on arrival because of whatever other problems there might be with it, he has included lots of money for the military. And there's absolutely no question that the United States has by far the world's best funded military operation. And we have military bases in somewhere upwards of 100 different countries around the world. The United States has the most extensive military operation in the world, and that takes a lot of money to support. So, of course, the military likes money. Whether or not they like Trump is sort of irrelevant.
Now, you talk in your article, Clemency for the Lowly, Free Passes for the Mighty, how there is, you know, this total double standard when it comes to actually prosecuting those who've committed crimes on the battlefield versus those who've sent them there. I mean, we still, you know, George W. Bush has managed to bizarrely whitewash his image. And even Obama, we've forgotten about the expanded drone wars under Obama. But I mentioned Trump was in Normandy. And again, no mention of the Nuremberg trials, a time when we did actually try to hold leaders of a war accountable, right?
Exactly right. And the principle that was established at Nuremberg was exactly that, that in fact you could, that international law is real law, that it has real consequences if you violate it, and that people at the very highest level of government can actually be held responsible for their crimes. And, you know, this was really what happened at Nuremberg was really, there aren't very many things that are new in the world, but this was actually a new thing. This was a group of four nations coming together and attempting pretty scrupulously, although there are certainly plenty of critiques about the Nuremberg tribunals, but really attempting to figure out what would be a just way to put on trial the people that they considered responsible for the most horrendous, barbaric period of time that Europe had ever seen. And, you know, I like to think about that when we think about Europe as the great civilization. Where is it that the greatest barbarism has happened, right? So they met and they came up with a charter that described the procedures by which they would put people on trial and also described what the actual crimes would be, because even that wasn't agreed, because the whole body of law that governs how people behave in war, some of it is written down. A lot of it consists of treaties that different countries have signed. Some of it now exists in resolutions of the Security Council at the United Nations, but there was no United Nations then. And so they really had to figure out and grapple with how are we going to put these people on trial. And in the end, they came up with three main categories: crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. And the one that they had the most fight about was this idea that it was actually illegal to make an unprovoked aggressive war. And you know, there had been no law on the books saying you couldn't invade other countries. But in 1928, all of the countries involved in World War II had signed a pact called the Kellogg-Briand Pact, in which they had all agreed that they would not settle disputes by making war against each other. They had essentially outlawed war. And this treaty, which is still in force today, becomes really the foundation of what's going to become the United Nations. And it's the foundation for this crime against peace that said, essentially, everything that Germany did comes out of that first aggression, that first invasion into other countries' territory, that first attempt to take over land and space that doesn't belong to the country. And that this first war making is the fountain out of which everything else, including the Holocaust, including all the other war crimes they committed, the Battle of Britain, all of that arises out of this first crime. And it's ironic that France and Russia were not so sure that they wanted to make this a crime, but it was the United States, and to a lesser extent, Great Britain, that insisted that, yes, this was the crucial crime. And I think this is still relevant for us today. When I think about the crimes, the war crimes the U.S. has committed since the attacks of 9/11, in an amazing way, almost all of them, they spring out of either what I still consider to have been an illegal invasion of Afghanistan, but certainly the invasion of Iraq. And that even includes the torture that I've been studying basically since 2001. The torture, the very first tortures, both at Guantanamo and at the CIA black sites, first in Afghanistan and then later around the world, the main thing they were trying to do in those early years before 2003 was to get somebody to say, yes, there was a connection from Saddam Hussein, the president of Iraq, and Al-Qaeda, the organization that attacked the United States on September 11th. There was no such connection, as it turns out, for a number of historical reasons, mainly that Saddam Hussein actually hated Al-Qaeda, even though they were both Sunni. There were other reasons why there was no connection at all. But all of the excesses that happened at Guantanamo in the U.S. prison there happened because Donald Rumsfeld and also Dick Cheney and the CIA really, really wanted to hear that there was this connection because they wanted an excuse to make war against Iraq. And the same thing.
And Colin Powell helped to make that happen.
Sadly, he did. He has since said, you know, essentially I was duped, but he absolutely did. Condoleezza Rice did. Colin Powell went in front of the United Nations and said, you know, there is this connection. And the reason we know is because we have people that we are holding who have told us so. And it was all lies.
And then if there was any justice in the world, those leaders would have faced trial and may have been serving sentences. And as you point out in your piece, lining up for pardons in front of Trump.
That's exactly right. And it's interesting, however, that none of them have left the United States since the end of the Bush administration.
Really?
In fact, there was a time, it's probably been 8 or 9 years ago now, when George W. Bush was invited to Switzerland to receive some kind of a prize from a group of evangelical Christians in Switzerland. And word came that there was some rogue district attorney who had actually sworn out a warrant for his arrest under laws in Switzerland that made it legal to arrest war criminals who happened to fetch up in Switzerland, and he decided not to go.
Wow. Well, the rest of the world may help hold American criminals accountable. Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your article from our website. Thanks so much.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Rebecca Gordon. She's the author of Mainstreaming Torture, Ethical Approaches in the Post-9/11 United States. She also teaches philosophy at University of San Francisco and is a member of the Wartime's Tiempo de Guerras Collective. We've been discussing her new article published by Tom Dispatch called Clemency for the Lowly, Free Passes for the Mighty. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and now on Spotify.